President Trump has said tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico will go into effect March 4th. Will they level the playing field for American producers? And what will they mean for your grocery bill? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to break down the impact of these tariffs and what it would take to reshape the U.S. food supply are Ohio farmer Chris Gibbs and Ohio State University Department of Agricultural, Environmental, and Development Economics Professor Ian Sheldon. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Ian, on February 1st, President Trump made this announcement that 25% tariffs on goods imported from Mexico and Canada would take effect. He paused those tariffs until March 4th, but has said they'll go into effect this week. Are food prices most likely to rise fastest if these tariffs do take effect?
Yeah, I believe that's probably the case. Our two biggest suppliers are Canada and Mexico, and we import about 60% of our vegetables from Mexico and about 47% of our fruit. And these commodities are both perishable and pretty hard to store. So it's tough to get inventory together in the retail system to sort of hedge against that. So I think we'd see pretty rapid price increases, particularly in fruit and vegetables, horticultural products. And in fact, for the US, over half of our imports come from those products, fruit and fresh vegetables.
Are higher tariffs on China taking effect this week too? And could those affect food prices, Ian?
Not so much. With respect to China, the big concern, and Chris can maybe speak to this as well, is China has until recently been one of our most important agricultural export markets. So it's with respect to China, I think it's more the retaliation that they take against our tariffs that are probably going to affect the agricultural sector here in Ohio specifically and in the U.S. generally.
Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are deja vu all over again. Back in 2018, then President Trump pulled the same stunt with applying punitive tariffs to all of our traditional trading partners, whether it's Mexico, Canada, Australia, EU, right on down the line, and China. China's certainly another discussion, but apply those punitive tariffs to all of our traditional trading partners and allies, I might add, which is a good word to use for today. And each of them, including China, retaliated against our, what I believe is the United States of America's soft underbelly, and that's agriculture. And particularly in China, where China was our largest importer of U.S. soybeans, retaliated against those. And I lost, as a farmer, literally 20% of the value of my crop overnight because of the retaliation. So if we fast forward to today, what I see, what I fear, what other farmers fear, and what are bracing for is retaliatory tariffs against, again, United States of America's soft underbelly, which I believe is agriculture. And I might add just at the end of the phrase here that just this morning, Reuters is reporting that China indeed is considering retaliatory tariffs on agricultural products. And certainly that would include soybeans and other commodities that we move into to China.
Chris, is there any way these tariffs would benefit you? Because the president keeps talking about how these tariffs will be good for American business. Is there any benefit to farmers to have these tariffs in place?
No, there's not. And I'll tell you why. Let me just make it real, real clear for your listeners. There's three commodities that farmers buy in bulk. Everything I buy or build is made primarily out of these three commodities: steel, aluminum, and lumber. Those are the things that farmers buy, okay? When we buy something new, build a building, buy a piece of machinery, I don't care what it is, a livestock trailer that's made out of aluminum, those three things are what the administration is applying tariffs to. primarily to some of these countries, China, or excuse me, Canada and Mexico in particular. So that's going to raise the price for me, because those costs, regardless of what the president continues to say, which is just, I'll be gentle, a fabrication, tariffs are not paid by the importer, excuse me, by the exporting country. They're not paid by Canada. They're not paid by Mexico. They're not paid by China. They are paid by U.S. importers, folks that bring these products into the United States. They pass those on. They would be passed on to farmers. They'll be passed on to farmers like me. There is zero upside for tariffs, both applied and both retaliatory against the American farmer.
And if your costs go up for those things that you're buying, Chris, I imagine you have to raise your prices to try to keep your business going. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no. I raise corn. We own and operate 560 acres. Corn, soybeans, wheat, alfalfa hay, and I've got 80 beef cows. I don't raise my prices on anything. I don't have control over raising my prices. I'm a seller of commodities, not quite so much in the beef business, because we're just a little bit different. We're more of a seed stock operation. But in the commodities, I don't have control over that. What I have control over is what I spend. I don't necessarily have control over, other than my marketing, the best I can do, control over my sales. So I can't dictate that price. So there's no raising my price for farmers.
So you just have to take the hit?
We just have to take the hit. And keep in mind that in the commodities, what I'm talking about, corn, soybeans, wheat, we are at or below the cost of production right now. Right now, we are at or below the cost of production in these commodities. And we're on the precipice of possibly growing far more corn this year, not because it's profitable, but because it's the commodity that we can grow with the least loss. What a terrible situation we can be put in. What a terrible situation we find ourselves in right at the moment. Tariffs will not help this. Retaliatory tariffs will be disastrous. And this is tough business. And I'll say one more thing before I pass it back. I'm embarrassed to say, I haven't finished purchasing the potash fertilizer that I need for this spring yet. I still need to get that. And it's based on a cash flow issue. I just didn't have the cash flow based on last year's commodity prices to continue or to finish purchasing that amount of potash for the nutrient needs that I need for my soybeans and corn. Where do we get 60% of our potash comes from in this United States? It comes from Canada. And we're going to make it Tuesday, we're going to make it 25% more expensive. And I have nowhere to go with that.
We're talking about President Trump's tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico and China and what they could mean for prices at the grocery store. We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Ian, you talked earlier about the fruits and vegetables that in the U.S. get from Mexico, that they're imported from Mexico. And Chris just talked about the potash from Canada. What are some of the other food products or agricultural products from Canada that could lead to higher prices at the grocery store when these tariffs take effect?
Well, I think actually Chris has already mentioned the most important one, which is potash. In fact, I checked the numbers. There was a study out of Illinois last week. Actually, 80% of our potash comes from Canada. So that's going to be a big kick. And remember, under the what used to be called NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and now the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, we virtually have free trade. That means virtually less than 1% tariffs pretty much across the board in the agricultural sector. So we have this highly integrated market here in North America. And that would be true, for example, in manufacturing in the automobile sector. But so I think that 25% increase on imports of potash, it will be quite critical. And as Chris pointed out, farmers' margins have actually been getting squeezed quite significantly over the past 18 months to 2 years. We've had high input prices, be it fertilizers or energy. And at the same time, commodity prices have been softening from where they were 2 or 3 years ago, particularly for soybeans and corn, although corn's picked up a little bit recently. But the president's putting in place a 10% import tariff on crude oil imports. And we import about 52% of our crude oil imports into the United States, come from Canada. And, you know, that would get refined into something like diesel, which would be an important component of Chris's costs as well. In terms of our other imports, I mean, we have sort of a highly integrated meat and livestock sector. So you might get young hogs are raised in Canada. They get sent down to Mexico for feeding out. The Mexicans import a lot of corn, yellow corn, to feed those animals. And then it gets sent back to the United States for processing. So I would imagine we might see some increases in livestock products where that's coming in from Mexico. But I think the big hit comes on fruit and vegetables, as far as I can tell.
Chris, I think there are people who aren't farmers, who aren't in the agriculture business, who might think, well, if we can't get the fruit and vegetables from Mexico, why not just start growing that stuff that we need here in the U.S. instead? Is that possible? Can U.S. farmers produce the food that we'd otherwise be importing from these other countries?
Well, the first thing you need to realize is geography. We have winter in the north, and so that makes the growing season for fruits and vegetables much more narrow. And that's the reason that many of the fruits and vegetables are grown in the south, in the Florida, and the, you know, even Texas and so forth. So, but grain farmers in the Midwest are built for the commodities. They're built for raising corn and soybeans, for soy oil, for meal, so forth. And those commodities that we use to feed livestock, to create meat proteins. You know, if you put, gee whiz, I've said this before, it makes people laugh, I guess, a little bit. If you take corn, soybean meal, and water and put it in a blender, and it'll squeal. It turns into a hog. That's what hogs are made out of. So that's what we do. And how do we feed a nation? How do we feed our export market with high-quality white and red meat proteins? We do that through corn, soybeans, and these other commodities. Raising amount of fruits and vegetables, let's increase that. Let's have a market for it. Let's find a way that a farmer can maybe grow some more fruits and vegetables. But you know what the first thing they're going to run into? They're going to run into labor problems. In AI, I put in an AI the other day. I said, okay, let's just have some fun. Let's say that the whole United States, 330 million people, are going to eat lettuce, potatoes, and tomatoes, okay? AI come up with the calculation. They said it took 21.7 million acres to do that if we were just going to eat vegetables. All right, where in the world are we going to get the labor to do that? It's hand labor to pick tomatoes. It's hand labor to pick strawberries. It's hand labor to do that. We've got a labor shortage now, and we're trying to export many of our immigrant workers and so forth. So is it possible? Sure. Will the consumer pay for those vegetables? Will they pay for them for me as a farmer to change my operation and instead of 560 acres, put out 60 acres of fruit and vegetables? It's possible, but I don't know where I'm going to get the labor.
Well, we are going to continue this conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we'll hear how you can tell if your boss is monitoring your productivity at work. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about the impact of President Trump's tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico. My guests are Ohio farmer Chris Gibbs and Ohio State University Department of Agricultural, Environmental, and Development Economics Professor Ian Sheldon. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Ian, we've talked on this program recently about how the price of eggs has increased because of bird flu. I understand the U.S. is now importing eggs from Turkey. Is that enough? Can we import our way out of our egg crisis?
You know, I'm not an expert on the egg market, and I'm still puzzled as to how we can import a very perishable, breakable product from Turkey, which, you know, I'm finding it hard to get my head around the economics of that. I don't think we can import our way out of this issue. I think we have to deal with the avian flu problem. Although there's, I read an article in the New York Times last week that suggested that there is some concern that the companies that wholesale the eggs, so from, you know, the producers of eggs through to the food retailers like Walmart and Kroger, that there might be some price gouging going on. So I don't pretend to be an expert on the egg issue, although I know it's on everybody's minds. I was in Fresh Time here in Columbus yesterday, and eggs were up to $7 for a dozen, and they were rationing the number of boxes of eggs that you were allowed to buy. So I think, you know, maybe Chris knows more about this than I do, but I wonder whether some of that, those eggs being imported, are actually liquid eggs that then go into, you know, food processing in the baking sector. So I'm it's a story I'd like to follow up. And maybe Chris knows more about this than I do.
Hmm. Chris, have you been following the egg crisis and egg imports?
Yeah, and I had not considered, and thank you for Ian for bringing that up, I had not considered that possibly those were liquid eggs, because it's no different than in the United States here. Many of our plants are cracking plants, where the eggs go directly to that. They end up in a carton, and that ends up in at McDonald's. One thing, you know, for omelets and so forth, one thing that folks need to realize about the egg market in the United States, and particularly here in Ohio, and I think we're maybe number two behind Iowa in the number of laying hens that we have, and we've now euthanized, gee whiz, 10 million of those, maybe 20 million in Western Ohio, Dark County, and Mercer County. And just a little bit of aside, I was a USDA director in Mercer County for about 23 years, retired in 2016, so I was pretty close to this. One thing that folks need to realize about the egg business is that it's highly, highly, highly integrated. Farmers like me don't own chickens. Okay, I'm not sure if I know any farmer that owns laying hens. What the farmer does is provide the building and the labor, okay? The feed and everything else, and much of the management is taken care of by an integrator, the company that is either in the middle or is in the process of selling those eggs to a final destination or to a cracking plant. So what that means is that we end up with kind of a monopoly at the top. And I'm not going to go into a big whine about monopolies, because we have that in agriculture. We have it in the beef business. There's only four major packers that control 80% of the beef market, of the beef packing and killing in the United States. So that's highly consolidated. The egg business is somewhat similar. It's highly integrated. And at the top, there are very few places that markets, I should say, because just a few companies control that. So that lends itself to conspiracy theories. And Ian may be correct that they can be kind of taken advantage of the situation here between now and when we end up raising more chickens. And by the way, they're going to have to decide, when I say they, I'm talking about the USDA, FDA, and EPA, going to have to decide if we're going to make a full-out full court press on vaccinations of hens and chickens. And that's going to start a whole nother discussion, particularly with the new Health and Human Services Director, RFK, Jr., her secretary, that is kind of leery about vaccinations. I'm not sure that vaccinating all the chickens and then trying to sell the eggs in the American market is going to play very well on the certainly on social media.
Well, yeah, and let's get back to tariffs. Senator Mitch McConnell wrote a commentary piece last month that started out talking about how the Smoot-Hawley tariff helped spiral the Wall Street crash of 1929 into a worldwide depression. What kind of risk, if any, do these tariffs pose on the broader economy?
I think there are tremendous risks. I mean, we've been talking just about 25% tariffs against Mexico and Canada, and initially 10% tariffs against China. But last week, the president layered on another 10%. And remember, those two 10% hikes were on top of all the tariffs that were implemented under the first Trump administration and which were never removed by the Biden administration. And those tariffs hit on average about 20%. So yeah, we're pushing our tariffs against these economies a lot closer to what the Smoot-Hawley tariffs were. And in fact, there's a bipartisan bill in Congress about removing what's called permanent normal trading relations with China. So when China joined the WTO in 2001, Congress stopped voting every year on whether we would implement tariffs of 4% on average against China or whether we would go back to Smoot-Hawley type of tariffs. But if that bill gets through Congress, it would codify over a five-year period tariff increases against China of anywhere from 35 to 100%. And on top of that, the president is talking about what he calls levying reciprocal tariffs. And what this means is looking at all the tariff lines for the US. There's over 12,000 individual tariff lines with 166 other members of the WTO. And let's suppose Europe has a 10% tariff on cars and the US only has a 5% tariff on automobile imports. We would raise our tariffs to that level. This would blow up the World Trade Organization. I mean, the World Trade Organization is kind of not very functional right now, but I think all the gains we've made in the post-war period of bringing down tariffs on average to quite low levels, that would end, and any kind of dispute resolution would be sort of blown up. And you have to remember that the free trade agreement we have with Mexico and Canada, which was negotiated by the president in the previous administration in 2020, it's up for review next year. It has a sunset clause in 2036. If we start unilaterally raising those tariffs, I'm not sure that Canada and Mexico are going to be too keen at the negotiating table to simply accept those tariff increases. So I think there's a potential for a real slowdown in economic growth here in the United States and globally potentially. And I think, inflation rates have been coming down here and elsewhere, but I think this has the potential to push up those rates of inflation. If you have this kind of level of widespread tariffs, it typically means the dollar is going to appreciate, which puts even more pressure on our export markets, although it does make our imports cheaper. So you get this trade-off between higher tariffs, but the actual cost of buying those goods on the market has fallen because our purchasing power has gone up. So I'm not very optimistic about the widespread effect of these tariffs if they're implemented across the board against more than just Canada and Mexico.
Chris, I know you spent many years as a leader of your county's Republican Party. You're no longer part of the Republican Party, but why do you think President Trump and other Republicans have latched on to this idea of tariffs?
Well, they've latched on to whatever idea that President Trump comes up with at the moment, and it's literally in real time. And the latest idea that the president has come up with is, I think if the listeners know Jonathan Goldberg, editor of the Dispatch, he wrote a piece over the weekend, and I think he talks something about spheres of influence. You know, what the Trump administration has become, and I hate to roll off into politics here, but this is important about tariffs, is that he's become like the Don Corleone of spheres of influence. And China has a sphere of influence. Another leader, whether it's Iran, has a sphere of influence, North Korea, whatever. Trump wants his own sphere of influence over the top of lower countries, and he can apply that with tariffs.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio farmer Chris Gibbs and Ohio State University Department of Agricultural, Environmental, and Development Economics Professor Ian Sheldon. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, some federal workers say Doge puts spyware on their computers. We'll hear how you can figure out if that's happening where you work. This is Cincinnati Edition.